Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll revisit a lot of what happened at Wednesday's anniversary of peace celebration in Dayton in honor of the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus takes us to the Dixie Drive-In. Up first, this week, the city of Dayton introduced a resolution that opposes Stand Your Ground legislation being considered at the Ohio State House. WYSO's Emily McCord reports.
Right now, Ohio law says you have the right to defend yourself if you're in your home. But if you're outside, you have to retreat. If House Bill 203 is passed, it would allow you to fight back anywhere. And Dayton is saying no thanks. Commissioner Nan Whaley says the proposed legislation won't help the city's initiative to reduce gun violence. And she says citizens have also raised concerns over the bill.
You know, a lot of the state legislation has a really direct effect on our community, both as the city organization and then, you know, our community at large. And so we feel like we have a responsibility to communicate with the state legislature on our positions on issues that would affect our community and the people living in the city of Dayton.
Advocates for the Stand Your Ground bill say it'll make Ohioans safer by giving them the right to defend themselves. The city's resolution will be sent to state lawmakers. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
A recent U.S. Census Bureau report shows one in three children nationwide grow up in a fatherless home. A local organization in Clark County helps local men become better fathers, and as WYSO's Wayne Baker reports, they have just received a new grant that will help the group called Urban Light Ministries serve more people.
The Ohio Commission on Fatherhood awarded Urban Light Ministries a four-year, $420,000 grant to partner with Ohio Job and Family Services to offer fatherhood programs in Clark, Montgomery, and Greene counties. Only six awards were given to agencies around the state. Urban Light CEO Eli Williams says the Fatherhood Improvement Program is called POPS Project 2.0. Williams says children who grow up with a father actively involved in their lives tend to have better outcomes.
They're more likely to not drop out of school. They're more likely to actually achieve in school. They're less likely to use drugs, join gangs, get pregnant, and the kinds of things that can sidetrack a child.
More than 300 fathers and families have participated in the fatherhood programming since 2006. Urban Lights hopes to add at least 200 more with the new grant. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Tomorrow is the last day of Cedar Fest, the town of Cedarville's yearly Labor Day weekend event. Cedar Fest honors their native son, known as the father of Labor Day. But as WYSO's Lewis Wallace reports, there's more of a backstory.
Police Chief Chris Gillaw's been around since Cedar Fest started in 1981.
If you come into Cedarville, you'll see signs at the beginning of Cedarville in the blue and white, basically stating that this is the home of Senator Kyle, father of Labor Day.
U.S. Senator James H. Kyle helped establish the national holiday in 1894. And around here, he's Cedarville's claim to fame. But Labor Day was actually first invented at least 10 years before that, when unions staged walkouts to demand a shorter workday. Caroline Merrithew is a history professor at the University of Dayton. She says these events were part strike, part party.
We're celebrating our common condition, our common plight, and remembering to have fun while we're doing it.
Which is why she thinks current events like Cedar Fest still fit the bill.
Those living in the 19th century would be happy about that.
The Cedar Fest parade kicks off at 1 p.m. today on North Main Street in Cedarville. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
And this week, Lewis spoke with WYSO's Emily McCord for Politics Ohio on the Ohio Senate Medicaid Finance Subcommittee. They wrapped up their three-part state tour with a stop in Dayton last Tuesday.
Members of the Ohio Senate Finance Committee came to CareSource to hear how Medicaid expansion would affect Ohioans and the state's bottom line. And to talk to me about that conversation is Lewis Wallace, WYSO's new economics reporter. Thanks for being here and welcome to WYSO.
Thanks, Emily.
Lewis, you heard from officials from major healthcare organizations and HMO providers, and you heard them testify to the subcommittee. And it seems that there were several areas that they felt that we could still expand Medicaid in the state and save costs. Can we talk about some of those?
Yeah, they were largely talking about what their already doing right, and just giving examples of ways that these HMOs have been cutting costs over recent years. So one good example is something that they call care coordination, which is basically when you come in to a Medicaid plan, it's confusing, there's all these details to deal with, and a lot of these bigger HMOs are actually hiring people whose whole job it is to help you navigate that system and make it through Medicaid, and that can actually lead to more effective healthcare, folks going to the emergency room less, returning less, dealing with things before they become a big problem, and cut costs in the long run. So they're arguing for more of that. Another area that they spoke to is the pharmacy benefit, which was returned to Medicaid recently, and that basically means folks are getting medications covered that keep them out of, again, more severe problems or longer hospital stays.
Yeah. So this idea of less emergency room visits, preventative care, that's something that we can actually quantify as cost savings.
Right. Exactly. And that it would be more preventative care, less sort of longer term issues developing.
And they propose that navigators will be walking people through the process, helping sort of address these issues.
Exactly.
So what about mental health and physical services? I understand that there's some cost savings there.
Another issue that HMOs were talking about was integrating mental health services with physical health services. And again, using kind of coordinators or touch points in the middle of that, that make sure that somebody that's dealing with multiple issues, say, diabetes and bipolar disorder at once, aren't sort of allowing those issues to come together in ways that can lead to, again, more expensive, long hospital visits because maybe their mental health care provider might not be aware of their issues with physical health and so on.
Anything else that the healthcare providers were talking about that could really save costs?
They were also talking about the sticky area of payment reform. Basically, the theme there is that HMOs want to make a shift away from billing and paying per service and towards a form of payment for healthcare in general and for Medicaid services that's about outcomes. So their kind of tagline is higher cost doesn't equal better health outcomes.
All of this must be really hard to quantify. You know, one of the Republicans' major concerns about expanding Medicaid is how much it's going to cost to bring all these new people under that umbrella. And then you're hearing from these healthcare providers saying, no, there's all these different ways that this can cut costs. So who's right here?
So it's complicated. The first thing to know about the Medicaid expansion is that for the first 3 years, it's 100% covered. Those new patients are 100% covered by the federal government. Right now in Ohio, the current Medicaid program is covered 60% by the federal government and 40% by the state. So the expanded Medicaid is never going to be proportionally as much as the current Medicaid program. That said, the current Medicaid program has a lot of issues with costs. The costs go up about a little more than 7% every year. A study came out just a couple of weeks ago that was the topic of another one of these hearings that evaluated the costs, and it basically compared this idea of capping the cost increase every year and expanding Medicaid with the idea of just continuing on as we have been. And actually, if we expanded Medicaid but capped the cost, we would see a lot of cost savings in the state of Ohio as soon as next year and billions of dollars by 2025. So it could be apples and oranges, but it does say that it's possible to expand Medicaid and also cut costs. And I think that's an option that some legislators are hoping will be on the table.
And what's happening next? We know that Republicans control both the House and the Senate and the state. What is the subcommittee going to do with that information they learned in Dayton this week?
So the subcommittee is going to bring it back to the legislature in September. I think various members of that committee are hoping to broker a compromise over Medicaid expansion, and that could mean going for it with this capped cost. That could mean not doing it, but maybe compromising on some other cost-cutting areas. The one part that it seemed like most people on that committee are in agreement with is this program right now is costing a little too much, and we need to be aware of what are some of the ways to limit that.
WYSO's economics reporter, Lewis Wallace, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Over the last few years, due to pressure from the film industry, more and more movie theaters have been converting their projection method from 35mm film to digital. While many small and independent theaters have been struggling to adapt, drive-in theaters in particular are at a crucial moment in this nationwide transition. Community Voices producer Lauren Chows takes us to Dayton's Dixie Twin Drive-In to find out why.
Between row after row of white poles, cars and trucks are lined up, ready for tonight's first feature. Moviegoers lounge on blankets and in lawn chairs. In the bed of one truck, Burt Whitaker has just inflated an air mattress. He says he comes to the drive-in every few weeks.
It's just an amazing experience to be laying, look up and see the stars moving around and the moon moving from one place to the other and the occasional meteor, and enjoy a perhaps half-baked, slightly good movie.
Helping Burt with the mattress is his friend, Mary Galloway, another frequent visitor to the Dixie Twin, where folks can see two movies for about two-thirds the price of a single indoor theater ticket. The way Mary sees it, part of the appeal of a trip to the drive-in is getting the most bang for the old proverbial buck.
You get to go out and have a meal. You get your movies. You get an abbreviated camping trip, you know, without getting stinky, so that's a plus.
When the Dixie Twin opened in 1957, which was just about at the peak of the popularity of drive-ins, there were nearly 5,000 of them around the U.S. Now there are just over 350 left, with Ohio operating 28 of these. The Dixie Twin is one of four drive-ins in the Miami Valley. The others are located in Fairborn, Springfield, and Wilmington, and these are all owned by local company Checkers Theaters Incorporated. According to Burt, who has visited all of the area drive-ins, one of the best parts of the experience is checking out the projection booth, which, in the Dixie Twins' case, contains much of the same equipment it had when it opened 56 years ago.
If you haven't seen one of the projection booths with all the equipment, you probably should. Just walk up there while they're running it and just knock on the door and say, "Hey, can I look at how this works?" You'll flip!
If the rumors circulating around the movie industry hold water, folks looking to flip had better do so fast. The scuttlebutt within the industry is that, by the end of the year, movie companies will stop printing new films on 35mm altogether and will only distribute them in digital format. According to Bill Nelson, the Dixie Twins' general manager, he's been hearing these rumors for a while.
The studios, for years now, have been trying to convert everybody to digital because it's much cheaper for them to produce a movie on a hard drive than it is to strike a film print. And they've always been threatening that very soon we're going to be cutting off 35mm film, so you need to hurry up and do this. They won't give you an exact deadline.
While there isn't a specific universal deadline, most film studios have essentially given notice that, after this year, they'll no longer release new films on 35mm. Bill says that the cost of upgrading to digital for small theaters isn't exactly chump change.
A digital projector right now is running anywhere from $75,000 to $85,000.
The Dixie Twins' two screens means they'll need two of these projectors. Bill also says the Dixie Twin would need to renovate its projection booth, which isn't air-conditioned, since digital projectors need climate control. Unlike their indoor counterparts, who operate year-round, the movie season for drive-ins doesn't begin until spring and will end when the good weather does. Most drive-ins will need to decide soon whether to upgrade or to take their chances that 35mm will still be around next year. Some theaters have already closed, knowing they couldn't make the investment. Philip Checkers, the CEO of Checkers Theaters Incorporated, stated via email this week that the company still intends to open all its area drive-ins for the 2014 season. The drive-ins will continue to show movies on 35mm while the company explores its digital options. For the Dixie Twin, it's not curtains just yet. This August, Honda launched Project Drive-In, a contest that seeks to help drive-ins by assisting some of them with a digital conversion. Drive-in supporters can log on to projectdrivein.com and vote for their favorite drive-in, once a day via the website and once a day via text message. The top five theaters with the most votes will receive digital upgrades to their projectors. The Dixie Twin is the only drive-in in the Miami Valley participating in the contest, and winning could spell greater security for its future. But what happens if they don't win? Here's Bill Nelson again.
Well, I'm optimistic that we will be able to make the numbers work. At the end of the season, me and the owner are going to sit down and crunch numbers. I can say that we have a very loyal customer base, and it's been a very good season so far for us, so we're hoping that we're going to be able to make it work.
Back at the Dixie Twin, Burt and Mary say they've heard about the drive-in's plight. Burt said he'd take it pretty hard if the Dixie Twin wasn't around in the future.
I think it would make summers a lot more lame.
Both Mary and Burt think that drive-ins aren't just a source of entertainment. They're an important piece of cultural identity.
It's good to have something that brings the community out, and we can see each other's faces and enjoy something together.
If anybody has not had a drive-in experience, I think you're missing a great part of what the American experience is all about.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Lauren Schaus.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. On Wednesday in downtown Dayton, several internationally important events centered around peace were celebrated. The 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech. It was also the 100th anniversary of the Peace Palace in The Hague, Netherlands. The Netherlands Peace Palace houses the International Court of Justice, which serves as the judicial body of the United Nations. It officially opened August 28, 1913, and that milestone played a part in Wednesday's celebrations. London Co. with Peace on Fifth, Dayton's Fair Trade and Compassionate Commerce store, says there was an element about Wednesday's event that reached beyond just talking about peace.
This is one way to kind of place a measuring stick on where we are in terms of peace and also look forward to new investments in our community for peace.
Few people would deny what Co. asserts, that even now, 100 years after the rise of the Peace Palace, 50 years after King's dream speech, the world still struggles to incorporate peace not just as a value system to be talked about, but as an activity to be practiced, and measuring that progress can be difficult.
But I would say to you, in the cleanest, easiest way, that peace is really about community support and our ability to get along. So we're supporting local business. We are supporting our local schools. We're paying attention to our kids when they do homework. We are going to farmers markets and buying from our local farmers. All of those are measures of peace. Why? Because they strengthen the community.
We have a number of people to speak today. We have some great proclamations. I'd like to thank
WYSO's Rev Cool hosted Wednesday's celebration, and Mayor Gary Leitzel opened the festivities on Courthouse Square by reading a proclamation. Leitzel says he believes Dayton is still working towards those ideals that King expressed in his speech.
Well, we're still not there yet. I mean, we're still struggling to make things equal for all people. And I think, we're taking the right steps. We have our Welcome Dayton plan. We have our domestic partner registry. I mean, it's bigger than black and white. It's for all of us. And I think we're sending a message here in Dayton that Dayton is a city for all people.
Anthony Whitmore is the Director of Government and Public Relations for the Greater Dayton Regional Transit Authority and chairperson for MLK Dayton, an organization dedicated to advancing the legacy of Dr. King. Whitmore says the March on Washington was as much about economics as it was about equality.
And isn't it ironic today, 50 years later, that we still are talking about freedom and we're talking about jobs? So here we are in the same boat as we were. Does that mean that we have not improved? Of course we have. Everyone has improved. But economically, I think that there are issues, and it doesn't matter what color you are, everyone is struggling.
Whitmore said Wednesday's event was a day to not only remember Dr. King, but remember his dream of bringing all people together.
All parts of our community, the first young lady.
Whitmore introduced four area students who inspired the audience with a reading of Dr. King's famous words 50 years after the civil rights leader encouraged the world to dream of peace one day.
I have a dream. Stephanie Patino Carvias. Stephanie is a senior at the Stuyvesant School for the Arts. Malia Mabry, she's in the eighth grade. She's also a student at the Stuyvesant Schools for the Arts. Sevda Mirzaiva, she is a Stebbins High School sophomore. And the only young man who will be presenting today, Mr. Joseph Sabin, who is at the wonderful excellent school, Mound Street Academy.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. 50 years ago, a great American, and with symbolic shadow we stand today, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came to us as a great beacon light of hope that gave millions of Negroes freedom. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long nights of captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is languished in the corners of the American society and has found himself an exile in his own land. And so we have come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they signed a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. A note that stated that all men, yes, black men as well as white, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note. Insofar as our citizens of color are concerned, instead of honoring the sacred obligation, America has given the Negro a bad check. A check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the opportunity vaults of this nation. And so we have come here to cash this check. A check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
We have also come to this hollow spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing act of drowglism. Now is the time to make the real promise of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time for our nation to lift itself from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all God's children. Let me be clear. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. The sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there's an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. And those who hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundation of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But there's something that I must say to my people who stand on the threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrong deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy a thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meaning physical force and soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to the distrust of all white people. For many of our brothers today, as evidenced by their presence, and they have come to realize that freedom is bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied. As long as the Negro is the very victim of unspeakable horrors of police brutality, we can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with fatigue of travel, cannot lodge in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities.
We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for white only. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote. As long as the Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until Justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from the areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by storms of persecutions, by the staggered winds of police brutality. You have been veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to South Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair.
I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the America dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right here in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring." And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening alligators of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from the Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and every molehill, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we all allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of old Negro spiritual, "Free at last! Free at last! God Almighty, we are free at last."
Let's hear it again. One big round of applause for those wonderful kids.
That was Stephanie Patino-Garcia, Zevda Mirzaiva, Malia Mabry, and Joseph Sabrin. Wednesday on Courthouse Square in Dayton. This is WISO Weekend.
Beautiful. And well spoken. What a privilege to have them. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. A community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening. You can hear this program and other WISO Weekend editions online at wyso.org. Coming up next, the Book Nook. Yeah.